Disc 2.
Mrs. Kidder departed, and Lucy, with time on her hands, scrubbed the kitchen table, which she had been longing to do, but which she had put off so as not to offend Mrs. Kidder, whose job it properly was. Then she cleaned the silver till it shone radiantly. She cooked lunch, cleared it away, washed it up, and at 2:30 was ready to start exploration. She had set out the tea things ready on a tray, with sandwiches and bread and butter, covered with a damp napkin to keep them moist. She strolled first round the gardens, which would be the normal thing to do. The kitchen garden was sketchily cultivated with a few vegetables. The hothouses were in ruins. The paths everywhere were overgrown with weeds. A herbaceous border near the house was the only thing that showed free of weeds and in good condition, and Lucy suspected that that had been Emma's hand. The gardener was a very old man, somewhat deaf, who was only making a show of working. Lucy spoke to him pleasantly. He lived in a cottage adjacent to the big stable yard. Leading out of the stable yard, a back drive led through the park, which was fenced on either side of it, and under a railway arch into a small back lane. Every few minutes a train thundered along the main line over the railway arch. Lucy watched the trains as they slackened speed, going round the sharp curve that encircled the Crackenthorpe property. She passed under the railway arch and out into the lane. It seemed a little used track. On the one side was the railway embankment. On the other was a high wall which enclosed some tall factory buildings. Lucy followed the lane until it came out into a street of small houses. She could hear a short distance away the busy hum of main road traffic. She glanced at her watch. A woman came out of a house nearby and Lucy stopped her. "Excuse me, can you tell me if there's a public telephone near here?" "Post office just at the corner of the road." Lucy thanked her and walked along until she came to the post office, which was a combination shop and post office. There was a telephone box at one side. Lucy went into it and made a call. She asked to speak to Miss Marple. A woman's voice spoke in a sharp bark.
"She's resting, and I'm not going to disturb her. She needs her rest. She's an old lady. Who shall I say called?"
"Miss Islesbarrow. There's no need to disturb her. Just tell her that I've arrived, and everything is going on well, and that I'll let her know when I have any news." She replaced the receiver and made her way back to Rutherford Hall. Chapter 5. "I suppose it'll be all right if I just practice a few iron shots in the park?" asked Lucy. "Oh, yes, certainly. Are you fond of golf?"
"Well, I'm not much good, but I like to keep in practice. It's a more agreeable form of exercise than just going for a walk." "Nowhere to walk outside this place," growled Mr. Crackenthorpe. "Nothing but pavements and miserable little bandboxes of houses. Like to get hold of my land and build more of them. But they won't until I'm dead, and I'm not going to die to oblige anybody, I can tell you that. Not to oblige anybody."
Emma Crackenthorpe said mildly, "Now, Father..."
"I know what they think and what they're waiting for. All of them. Cedric, and that sly fox Harold with his smug face. As for Alfred, I wonder he hasn't had a shot at bumping me off himself. Not sure he didn't at Christmas time. That was a very odd turn I had. Puzzled old Quimper. He asked me a lot of discreet questions."
"Everyone gets these digestive upsets now and again, Father."
"All right, all right. Say straight out that I ate too much. That's what you mean. And why did I eat too much? Because there was too much food on the table. Far too much. Wasteful and extravagant. And that reminds me, you, young woman. 5 potatoes you sent in for lunch. Good-sized ones, too. 2 potatoes are enough for anybody. So don't send in more than 4 in future. The extra one was wasted today."
"It wasn't wasted, Mr. Crackenthorpe. I've planned to use it in a Spanish omelette tonight." As Lucy went out of the room carrying the coffee tray, she heard him say,
"Slick young woman, that. Always got all the answers. Cooks well, though. And she's a handsome kind of girl."
Lucy Islesborough took a light iron out of the set of golf clubs she had had the forethought to bring with her and strolled out into the park, climbing over the fencing. She began playing a series of shots. After 5 minutes or so, a ball, apparently sliced, pitched on the side of the railway embankment. Lucy went up and began to hunt about for it. She looked back towards the house. It was a long way away, and nobody was in the least interested in what she was doing. She continued to hunt for the ball. Now and then she played shots from the embankment down into the grass. During the afternoon, she searched about a third of the embankment. Nothing. She played her ball back towards the house. Then, on the next day, she came upon something. A thorn bush growing about halfway up the bank had been snapped off. Bits of it lay scattered about. Lucy examined the tree itself. Impaled on one of the thorns was a torn scrap of fur. It was almost the same colour as the wood, a pale brownish colour. Lucy looked at it for a moment. Then she took a pair of scissors out of her pocket and snipped it carefully in half. The half she had snipped off, she put in an envelope which she had in her pocket. She came down the steep slope, searching about for anything else. She looked carefully at the rough grass of the field. She thought she could distinguish a kind of track which someone had made walking through the long grass, but it was very faint, not nearly so clear as her own tracks were. It must have been made some time ago, and it was too sketchy for her to be sure that it was not merely imagination on her part. She began to hunt carefully down in the grass at the foot of the embankment, just below the broken thorn bush. Presently, her search was rewarded. She found a powder compact, a small, cheap, enameled affair. She wrapped it in her handkerchief and put it in her pocket. She searched on, but did not find anything more. On the following afternoon, she got into her car and went to see her invalid aunt. Emma Crackenthorpe said kindly, "Oh, don't hurry back. We shan't want you until dinner time." "Oh, thank you, but I shall be back by 6 at the latest." Number 4 Madison Road was a small drab house in a small drab street. It had very clean Nottingham lace curtains, a shining white doorstep, and a well-polished brass door handle. The door was opened by a tall, grim-looking woman dressed in black with a large knob of iron-grey hair. She eyed Lucy in suspicious appraisal as she showed her into Miss Marple. Miss Marple was occupying the back sitting room, which looked out onto a small, tidy square of garden. It was aggressively clean, with lots of mats and doilies and a great many china ornaments, a rather big Jacobean suite, and 2 ferns in pots. Miss Marple was sitting in a big chair by the fire, busily engaged in crocheting. Lucy came in and shut the door. She sat down in the chair facing Miss Marple. "Well," she said, "it looks as though you were right." She produced her finds and gave the details of their finding. A flush of achievement came into Miss Marple's cheeks. "Perhaps one ought not to feel so," she said, "but it is rather gratifying to form a theory and get proof that it is correct." She fingered the small tuft of fur. "Elspeth said the woman was wearing a light-coloured fur coat. I suppose the compact was in the pocket of the coat and fell out as the body rolled down the slope. It doesn't seem distinctive in any way, but it may help. You didn't take all the fur?" "No, I left half of it on the thorn bush." Miss Marple nodded approval. "Quite right. You are very intelligent, my dear. The police will want to check exactly. You you are going to the police with these things? Well, not quite yet, Miss Marple considered. It would be better, I think, to find the body first, don't you?
Yes, but isn't that rather a tall order? I mean, granting that your estimate is correct. The murderer pushed the body out of the train, then presumably got out himself at Brackhampton, and at some time, probably that same night, came along and removed the body. But what happened after that? He may have taken it anywhere.
Not anywhere, said Miss Marple. I don't think you followed the thing to its logical conclusion, my dear Miss Islesborough. Oh, do call me Lucy. Why not anywhere? Because if so, he might much more easily have killed the girl in some lonely spot and driven the body away from there. You haven't appreciated... Lucy interrupted. Are you saying... Do you mean that this was a premeditated crime? I didn't think so at first, said Miss Marple. Well, one wouldn't, naturally. It seemed like a quarrel, and a man losing control and strangling the girl and then being faced with the problem of disposing of his victim. A problem which he had to solve within a very few minutes. But it really is too much of a coincidence that he should kill the girl in a fit of passion and then look out of the window and find the train was going round a curve exactly at a spot where he could tip the body out, and where he could be sure of finding his way later and removing it. If he had just thrown her out there by chance, he'd have done no more about it, and the body would, long before now, have been found. She paused. Lucy stared at her. You know, said Miss Marple thoughtfully, it's really quite a clever way to have planned a crime. And I think it was very carefully planned. There's something so anonymous about a train. If he'd killed her in the place where she lived or was staying, somebody might have noticed him come or go. Or if he'd driven her out in the country somewhere, someone might have noticed the car and its number and make. But a train is full of strangers coming and going. In a non-corridor carriage, alone with her, it was quite easy, especially if you realize that he knew exactly what he was going to do next. He knew, he must have known, all about Rutherford Hall. Its geographical position, I mean, its queer isolation, an island bounded by railway lines.
It is exactly like that, said Lucy. It's an anachronism out of the past. Bustling urban life goes on all round it, but doesn't touch it. The tradespeople deliver in the mornings, and that's all. So we assume, as you said, that the murderer comes to Rutherford Hall that night. It is already dark when the body falls, and no one is likely to discover it before the next day.
No, indeed.
The murderer would come how? In a car? Which way? Lucy considered. There's a rough lane alongside a factory wall. He'd probably come that way. Turn in under the railway arch and along the back drive. Then he could climb the fence, go along at the foot of the embankment, find the body, and carry it back to the car.
And then, continued Miss Marple, he took it to some place he had already chosen beforehand. This was all thought out, you know. And I don't think, as I say, that he would take it away from Rutherford Hall, or if so, not very far. The obvious thing, I suppose, would be to bury it somewhere. She looked inquiringly at Lucy.
I suppose so, said Lucy, considering. But it wouldn't be quite as easy as it sounds, Miss Marple agreed. He couldn't bury it in the park. Too hard work and very noticeable.
Somewhere where the earth was turned already?
The kitchen garden, perhaps.
But that's very close to the gardener's cottage.
Why, he's old and deaf, but it still might be risky.
Is there a dog?
No.
Then, in a shed, perhaps? Or an outhouse? Well, that would be simpler and quicker. There are a lot of unused old buildings, broken-down pigsties, harness rooms, workshops that nobody ever goes near. Or he might perhaps thrust it into a clump of rhododendrons or shrubs somewhere. Miss Marple nodded. Yes, I think that's much more probable. There was a knock on the door, and the grim Florence came in with a tray.
Nice for you to have a visitor, she said, to Miss Marple. I made you my special scones you used to like.
Florence always made the most delicious tea cakes, said Miss Marple. Florence, gratified, creased her features into a totally unexpected smile and left the room. I think, my dear, said Miss Marple, we won't talk any more about murder during tea. It's such an unpleasant subject. After tea, Lucy rose.
I'll be getting back, she said. As I've already told you, there's no one actually living at Rutherford Hall who could be the man we're looking for. There's only an old man and a middle-aged woman, and an old deaf gardener.
I didn't say he was actually living there, said Miss Marple. All I mean is that he's someone who knows Rutherford Hall very well. But we can go into that after you've found the body.
You seem to assume quite confidently that I shall find it, said Lucy. I don't feel nearly so optimistic.
I'm sure you will succeed, my dear Lucy. You are such an efficient person.
In some ways, but I haven't had any experience in looking for bodies.
I'm sure all it needs is a little common sense, said Miss Marple encouragingly.
Lucy looked at her, then laughed. Miss Marple smiled back at her.
Lucy set to work systematically the next afternoon. She poked round outhouses, prodded the briars which wreathed the old pigsties, and was peering into the boiler room under the greenhouse when she heard a dry cough and turned to find old Hillman, the gardener, looking at her disapprovingly.
"You be careful you don't get a nasty fall, miss," he warned her. "Them steps isn't safe. And you was up in the loft just now. And the floor there ain't safe, neither."
Lucy was careful to display no embarrassment.
"I expect you think I'm very nosy," she said cheerfully. "I was just wondering if something couldn't be made out of this place. Growing mushrooms for the market, that sort of thing. Everything seems to have been let go terribly."
"That's master, that is. Won't spend a penny. Ought to have two men and a boy here, I ought. Ought to keep the place proper. But won't hear it, he won't. Had all I could do to make him get a motor mower. Wanted me to mow all that front grass by hand, he did.
But if the place could be made to pay with some repairs..."
"Won't get a place like this to pay. Too far gone. And he wouldn't care about that anyway. Only cares about saving. Knows well enough what'll happen after he's gone. The young gentlemen'll sell up as fast as they can. Only waiting for him to pop off, they are. Going to come into a tidy lot of money when he dies, so I've heard."
"I suppose he's a very rich man," said Lucy.
"Crackenthorpe's fancies, that's what they are. The old gentleman started it, Mr. Crackenthorpe's father. A sharp one he was, by all counts. Made his fortune and built this place. Hard as nails, they say. Never forgot an injury. But with all that, he was open-handed. Nothing of the miser about him. Disappointed in both his sons, so the story goes. Given education and brought them up to be gentlemen, Oxford and all. But they were too much gentlemen to want to go into the business. The younger one married an actress and then smashed himself up in a car accident when he'd been drinking. The elder one, our one here, his father never fancied so much. Abroad a lot he was. Bought a lot of Eden statues and had them sent home. Wasn't so close with his money when he was young. Come on him, more in middle age, he did. No, they never did hit it off, him and his father. So I've heard."
Lucy digested this information with an air of polite interest. The old man leant against the wall and prepared to go on with his saga. He much preferred talking to doing any work.
"Died afore the war, the old gentleman did. Terrible temper he had. Didn't do to give him any sauce, he wouldn't stand for it.
And after he died, this Mr. Crackenthorpe came and lived here?
Him and his family, yes. Night a grown-up they was by then.
But surely... Oh, I see. You mean the 1914 war?
No, I don't. Died in 1928, that's what I mean.
Lucy supposed that 1928 qualified as before the war, but it was not the way she would have described it herself. She said, Well, I expect you'll be wanting to go on with your work. You mustn't let me keep you.
Ah, said old Hillman without enthusiasm. Ah, not much you can do this time of day. Light's too bad.
Lucy went back to the house, pausing to investigate a likely-looking copse of birch and azalea on her way. She found Emma Crackenthorpe standing in the hall reading a letter. The afternoon post had just been delivered. My nephew will be here tomorrow with a school friend. Alexander's room is the one over the porch. The one next to it will do for James Stoddart West. They'll use the bathroom just opposite. Yes, Miss Crackenthorpe. I'll see the rooms are prepared. They'll arrive in the morning before lunch. She hesitated. I expect they'll be hungry.
I bet they will, said Lucy.
Roast beef, do you think? And perhaps treacle tart? Oh, Alexander's very fond of treacle tart. The two boys arrived on the following morning. They both had well-brushed hair, suspiciously angelic faces, and perfect manners. Alexander Eastley had fair hair and blue eyes. Stoddart West was dark and spectacled. They discoursed gravely during lunch on events in the sporting world, with occasional references to the latest space fiction. Their manner was that of elderly professors discussing Paleolithic implements. In comparison with them, Lucy felt quite young. The sirloin of beef vanished in no time, and every crumb of the treacle tart was consumed. Mr. Crackenthorpe grumbled,
You two leap me out of house and home.
Alexander gave him a blue-eyed, reproving glance.
We'll have bread and cheese if you can't afford meat, Grandfather.
Afford it? I can afford it. I don't like waste.
We haven't wasted any, sir, said Stoddart West, looking down at his place, which bore clear testimony of that fact.
You boys both eat twice as much as I do.
We're at the bodybuilding stage, Alexander explained. We need a big intake of proteins.
The old man grunted. As the two boys left the table, Lucy heard Alexander say apologetically to his friend,
You mustn't pay any attention to my grandfather. He's on a diet or something. That makes him rather peculiar. He's terribly mean, too. I think it must be a complex of some kind.
Stoddart West said comprehendingly,
I had an aunt who kept thinking she was going bankrupt. Really, she had oodles of money. Pathological, the doctor said. Have you got that football, Alex?
After she'd cleared away and washed up lunch, Lucy went out. She could hear the boys calling out in the distance on the lawn. She herself went in the opposite direction, down the front drive, and from there she struck across to some clumped masses of rhododendron bushes. She began to hunt carefully, holding back the leaves and peering inside. She moved from clump to clump systematically, and was raking inside with a golf club when the polite voice of Alexander Eastley made her start.
"Are you looking for something, Miss Islesborough?"
"A golf ball," said Lucy promptly.
"Several golf balls, in fact. I've been practising golf shots most afternoons, and I've lost quite a lot of balls. I thought that today I really must find some of them."
"We'll help you," said Alexander obligingly.
"Well, that's very kind of you. I thought you were playing football."
"One can't go on playing footer," explained Stoddart West. "One gets too hot."
"Do you play a lot of golf?"
"I'm quite fond of it. I don't get much opportunity."
"I suppose you don't. You do the cooking here, don't you?"
"Yes."
"Did you cook the lunch today?"
"Yes. Was it all right?"
"Oh, simply wizard," said Alexander. "We had awful meat at school, all dried up. I love beef that's pink and juicy inside. That treacle tart was pretty smashing, too."
"You must tell me what things you like best."
"Could we have apple meringue one day? It's my favourite thing."
Well, of course. Alexander sighed happily.
There's a clock golf set under the stairs, he said. We could fix it up on the lawn and do some putting. What about it, Stoddard?
Good, oh, said Stoddart West.
He isn't really Australian, explained Alexander courteously, but he's practising talking that way in case his people take him out to see the test match next year. Encouraged by Lucy, they went off to get the clock golf set. Later, as she returned to the house, she found them setting it out on the lawn and arguing about the position of the numbers.
We don't want it like a clock, said Stoddart West. That's kid stuff. We want to make a course of it. Long holes and short ones. It's a pity the numbers are so rusty. You can hardly see them.
They need a lick of white paint, said Lucy. You might get some tomorrow and paint them.
Good idea. Alexander's face lit up. I say, I believe there's some old pots of paint in the long barn, left there by the painters last halls. Shall we see?
What's a long barn? Asked Lucy. Alexander pointed to a long stone building a little way from the house near the back drive.
It's quite old, he said. Grandfather called it a leek barn and says it's Elizabethan, but that's just swank. It belonged to the farm that was here originally. My great-grandfather pulled it down and built this awful house instead.
He added, a lot of grandfather's collection is in the barn. Things he had sent home from abroad when he was a young man. Most of them are pretty frightful, too.
The long barn's used sometimes for whist drives and things like that, Women's Institute stuff, and conservative sales of work. Come and see it.
Lucy accompanied them willingly. There was a big nail-studded oak door to the barn. Alexander raised his hand and detached a key on a nail just under some ivy to the right hand of the top of the door. He turned it in the lock, pushed the door open, and they went in. At a first glance, Lucy felt that she was in a singularly bad museum. The heads of two Roman emperors in marble glared at her out of bulging eyeballs. There was a huge sarcophagus of a decadent Greco-Roman period. A simpering Venus stood on a pedestal, clutching her falling draperies. Besides these works of art, there were a couple of trestle tables, some stacked-up chairs, and sundry oddments such as a rusted hand-mower, two buckets, a couple of moth-eaten car sheets, and a green-painted iron garden seat that had lost a leg.
"I think I saw the paint over here," said Alexander vaguely.
He went to a corner and pulled aside a tattered curtain that shut it off. They found a couple of paint pots and brushes, the latter dry and stiff.
"He really needs some turps," said Lucy.
They could not, however, find any turpentine. The boys suggested bicycling off to get some, and Lucy urged them to do so. Painting the clock golf numbers would keep them amused for some time, she thought. The boys went off, leaving her in the barn.
"This really could do with a clear-up," she had murmured.
"I shouldn't bother," Alexander advised her. "It gets cleaned up if it's going to be used for anything, but it's practically never used at this time of year."
"Do I hang the key up outside the door again? Is that where it's kept?"
"Yes. There's nothing to pinch here, you see. Nobody would want those awful marble things, and anyway, they weigh a ton."
Lucy agreed with him. She could hardly admire Mr. Crackenthorpe's taste in art. He seemed to have an unerring instinct for selecting the worst specimen of any period. She stood looking round her after the boys had gone. Her eyes came to rest on the sarcophagus and stayed there. That sarcophagus. The air in the barn was faintly musty, as though unaired for a long time. She went over to the sarcophagus. It had a heavy, close-fitting lid. Lucy looked at it speculatively. Then she left the barn, went to the kitchen, found a heavy crowbar, and returned. It was not an easy task, but Lucy toiled doggedly. Slowly the lid began to rise, prized up by the crowbar. It rose sufficiently for Lucy to see what was inside. Chapter 6 A few minutes later, Lucy, rather pale, left the barn, locked the door, and put the key back on the nail. She went rapidly to the stables, got out her car, and drove down the back drive. She stopped at the post office at the end of the road. She went into the telephone box, put the money in, and dialed. "I want to speak to Miss Marple."
"She's resting, miss. It's Miss Aylesborough, isn't it?"
"Yes."
"I'm not going to disturb her, and that's flat, miss. She's an old lady, and she needs her rest."
"You must disturb her. It's urgent.
I'm not... Please do what I say at once."
When she chose, Lucy's voice could be as incisive as steel. Florence knew authority when she heard it. Presently, Miss Marple's voice spoke.
"Yes, Lucy?"
Lucy drew a deep breath.
"You were quite right," she said. "I found it."
"A woman's body?"
"Yes. A woman in a fur coat. It's in a stone sarcophagus, in a kind of barn-cum-museum near the house. What do you want me to do? I ought to inform the police, I think."
"Yes, you must inform the police at once."
"But what about the rest of it? About you? The first thing they want to know is why I was prying up a lid that weighs tons for apparently no reason. Do you want me to invent a reason? I can."
"No, I think you know," said Miss Marple in her gentle, serious voice, "that the only thing to do is to tell the exact truth."
"About you?"
"About everything." A sudden grin split the whiteness of Lucy's face.
"That will be quite simple for me," she said, "but I imagine they'll find it quite hard to believe."
She rang off, waited a moment, and then rang and got the police station.
"I have just discovered a dead body in a sarcophagus in the long barn at Rutherford Hall."
"What's that?"
Lucy repeated her statement, and, anticipating the next question, gave her name. She drove back, put the car away, and entered the house. She paused in the hall for a moment, thinking. Then she gave a brief, sharp nod of the head, and went to the library where Miss Crackenthorpe was sitting helping her father to do the Times crossword. "Can I speak to you a moment, Miss Crackenthorpe?" Emma looked up, a shade of apprehension on her face. The apprehension was, Lucy thought, purely domestic. In such words do useful household staff announce their imminent departure.
"Well, speak up, girl, speak up,"
said old man Crackenthorpe irritably. Lucy said to Emma, "I'd like to speak to you alone, please."
"Nonsense," said Mr. Crackenthorpe. "You say straight out here what you've got to say."
"Just a moment, father." Emma rose and went towards the door.
"All nonsense. It can wait," said the old man angrily.
"I'm afraid it can't wait," said Lucy. Mr. Crackenthorpe said,
"What impertinence!"
Emma came out into the hall. Lucy followed her and shut the door behind them.
"Yes," said Emma. "What is it? If you think there's too much to do with the boys here, I can help you, and..."
"It's not that at all," said Lucy. "I didn't want to speak before your father, because I understand he is an invalid, and it might give him a shock. You see, I've just discovered the body of a murdered woman in that big sarcophagus in the long barn." Emma Crackenthorpe stared at her.
"In the sarcophagus? A murdered woman? It's impossible."
"I'm afraid it's quite true. I've rung up the police. They will be here at any minute." A slight flush came into Emma's cheek.
"You should have told me first, before notifying the police."
"I'm sorry," said Lucy.
"I didn't hear you ring up." Emma's glance went to the telephone on the hall table.
"I rang up from the post office just down the road."
"But how extraordinary. Why not from here?"
Lucy thought quickly. "I was afraid the boys might be about, might hear if I rang up from the hall here."
"I see. Yes, yes, I see. They are coming, the police, I mean."
"They're here now," said Lucy, as with a squeal of brakes, a car drew up at the front door, and the front door bell pealed through the house. I'm sorry, very sorry, to have asked this of you, said Inspector Bacon. His hand under her arm, he led Emma Crackenthorpe out of the barn. Emma's face was very pale. She looked sick, but she walked firmly erect. I'm quite sure that I've never seen the woman before in my life.
We're very grateful to you, Miss Crackenthorpe.
That's all I wanted to know.
Perhaps you'd like to lie down?
I must go to my father. I telephoned to Dr. Quimper as soon as I heard about this, and the doctor is with him now. Dr. Quimper came out of the library as they crossed the hall. He was a tall, genial man with a casual, off-hand, cynical manner that his patients found very stimulating. He and the inspector nodded to each other.
Miss Crackenthorpe has performed an unpleasant task very bravely, said Bacon.
Well done, Emma, said the doctor, patting her on the shoulder. You can take things. I've always known that. Your father's all right. Just go in and have a word with him, and then go into the dining room and get yourself a glass of brandy. That's a prescription. Emma smiled at him gratefully and went into the library. That woman's the salt of the earth, said the doctor, looking after her. A thousand pities she's never married. The penalty of being the only female in a family of men. The other sister got clear. Married at 17, I believe. This one's quite a handsome woman, really. She'd have been a success as a wife and mother.
All too devoted to her father, I suppose, said Inspector Bacon.
She's not really as devoted as all that. But she's got the instinct some women have to make their menfolk happy. She sees that her father likes being an invalid, so she lets him be an invalid. She's the same with her brothers. Cedric feels he's a good painter. What's his name? Harold. Knows how much she relies on his sound judgment. She lets Alfred shock her with his stories of his clever deals. Oh, yes. She's a clever woman. No fool. Well, do you want me for anything? Want me to have a look at your corpse now Johnston has done with it? Johnston was the police surgeon. And see if it happens to be one of my medical mistakes?
I'd like you to have a look, yes, Doctor.
We want to get her identified.
I suppose it's impossible for old Mr. Crackenthorpe. Too much of a strain.
Strain? Fiddlesticks. He'd never forgive you or me if you didn't let him have a peep. It's all agog. Most exciting thing that's happened to him for 15 years or so. And it won't cost him anything.
There's nothing really much wrong with him, then?
He's 72, said the doctor. That's all really that's the matter with him. He has odd rheumatic twinges. Who doesn't? So he calls it arthritis. He has palpitations after meals, as well he may. He puts them down to heart. But he can always do anything he wants to. I've plenty of patients like that. The ones who are really ill usually insist desperately that they're perfectly well. Come on, let's go and see this body of yours. Unpleasant, I suppose.
Johnston estimates she'd been dead between a fortnight and 3 weeks.
Ah, quite unpleasant, then. The doctor stood by the sarcophagus and looked down with frank curiosity, professionally unmoved by what he had named the unpleasantness.
Never seen her before. No patient of mine. Don't remember ever seeing her about in Brackhampton. She must have been quite good-looking once. Somebody had it in for her, all right.
They went out again into the air. Dr. Quimper glanced up at the building.
Found in the... what do they call it?
The Long Barn.
In a sarcophagus? That was fantastic.
Who found her?
Miss Lucy Islesborough.
Oh, the latest lady help.
What was she doing? Poking about in sarcophagi.
That, said Inspector Bacon grimly, is just what I am going to ask her.
Now, about Mr. Crackenthorpe, will you...
I'll bring him along. Mr. Crackenthorpe, muffled in scarves, came walking at a brisk pace, the doctor beside him.
Disgraceful, he said. Absolutely disgraceful. I brought back that sarcophagus from Florence in, well, let me say, it must have been in 1908, or was it 1909?
Steady now, the doctor warned him. This isn't going to be nice, you know.
No matter how ill I am, I've got to do my duty, haven't I?
A very brief visit inside the long barn was, however, quite long enough. Mr. Crackenthorpe shuffled out into the air again with remarkable speed.
Never saw her before in my life, he said. How does it mean? Absolutely disgraceful. It wasn't Florence, I remember now, it was Naples. Very fine specimen. And some fool of a woman has to come and get herself killed in it.
He clutched the folds of his overcoat on the left side.
Too much for me. My heart... Where's Emma? Doctor?
Dr. Quimper took his arm. You'll be all right, he said. I prescribe a little stimulant. Brandy. They went back together towards the house.
Sir? Please, sir?
Inspector Bacon turned. Two boys had arrived, breathless, on bicycles. Their faces were full of eager pleading.
Please, sir, can we see the body?
No, you can't, said Inspector Bacon.
Oh, sir, please, sir.
You never know. We might know who she was.
Oh, please, sir, do be a sport. It's not fair. Here's a murder right in our own barn. It's a sort of chance it may never happen again. Do be a sport, sir.
Who are you two?
I'm Alexander Eastley, and this is my friend, James Stoddart West.
Have you ever seen a blonde woman wearing a light-coloured dyed squirrel coat anywhere about the place?
Well, I can't remember exactly, said Alexander astutely. If I were to have a look...
Take him in, Sanders, said Inspector Bacon to the constable who was standing by the barn door. One's only young once.
Oh, sir, thank you, sir.
Both boys were vociferous.
It's very kind of you, sir.
Bacon turned away towards the house. And now, he said to himself grimly, for Miss Lucy Islesbarrow. After leading the police to the long barn and giving a brief account of her actions, Lucy had retired into the background, but she was under no illusion that the police had finished with her. She had just finished preparing potatoes for chips that evening when word was brought to her that Inspector Bacon required her presence. Putting aside the large bowl of cold water and salt in which the chips were reposing, Lucy followed the policeman to where the inspector awaited her. She sat down and awaited his questions composedly. She gave her name and her address in London and added of her own accord, I will give you some names and addresses of references if you want to know all about me. The names were very good ones. An admiral of the fleet, the provost of an Oxford college, and a dame of the British Empire. In spite of himself, Inspector Bacon was impressed. Now, Miss Islesbarrow, you went into the long barn to find some paint, is that right? And after having found the paint, you got a crowbar, forced up the lid of this sarcophagus, and found the body. What were you looking for in the sarcophagus?
I was looking for a body, said Lucy.
You were looking for a body, and you found one. Doesn't that seem to you a very extraordinary story?
Oh, yes, it is an extraordinary story. Perhaps you will let me explain it to you.
I certainly think you had better do so.
Lucy gave him a precise recital of the events which had led up to her sensational discovery.
The inspector summed it up in an outraged voice. You were engaged by an elderly lady to obtain a post here and to search the house and grounds for a dead body, is that right?
Yes.
Who is this elderly lady?
Miss Jane Marple. She is at present living at 4 Madison Road.
The inspector wrote it down. You expect me to believe this story?
Lucy said gently, not perhaps until after you have interviewed Miss Marple and got her confirmation of it.
Oh, I shall interview her all right. She must be cracked.
Lucy forbore to point out that to be proved right is not really a proof of mental incapacity. Instead, she said, "What are you proposing to tell Miss Crackenthorpe? About me, I mean."
"Why do you ask?"
"Well, as far as Miss Marple is concerned, I've done my job. I found the body she wanted found. But I'm still engaged by Miss Crackenthorpe, and there are two hungry boys in the house, and probably some more of the family will be coming down after all this upset. She needs domestic help. If you go and tell her that I only took this post in order to hunt for dead bodies, she'll probably throw me out. Otherwise, I can get on with my job and be useful." The inspector looked hard at her.
"I'm not saying anything to anyone at present," he said. "I haven't verified your statement yet. For all I know, you may be making the whole thing up."
Lucy rose. "Thank you. Then I'll go back to the kitchen and get on with things." Chapter 7.
"We'd better have the yard in on it. Is that what you think, Bacon?"
The chief constable looked inquiringly at Inspector Bacon. The inspector was a big, solid man. His expression was that of one utterly disgusted with humanity.
"The woman wasn't local, sir," he said. "There's some reason to believe, from her underclothing, that she might have been a foreigner. Of course," added Inspector Bacon hastily, "I'm not letting on about that yet a while. We're keeping it up our sleeves until after the inquest."
The chief constable nodded. "The inquest will be purely formal, I suppose?"
"Yes, sir. I've seen the coroner."
"And it's fixed for when?"
Tomorrow. I understand the other members of the Crackenthorpe family will be here for it. There's just a chance one of them might be able to identify her. They'll all be here."
He consulted a list he held in his hand.
"Harold Crackenthorpe, he's something in the city, quite an important figure, I understand. Alfred, don't quite know what he does. Cedric, that's the one who lives abroad. Paints."
The inspector invested the word with its full quota of sinister significance. The chief constable smiled into his moustache. "No reason is there to believe the Crackenthorpe family are connected with the crime in any way?" he asked.
"Well, not apart from the fact that the body was found on the premises," said Inspector Bacon. "And, of course, it's just possible that this artist member of the family might be able to identify her. What beats me is this extraordinary rigmarole about the train."
"Ah, yes. You've been to see this old lady, this, He glanced at the memorandum lying on his desk. "Miss Marple?"
"Yes, and she's quite set and definite about the whole thing. Whether she's balmy or not, I don't know, but she sticks to her story about what her friend saw and all the rest of it. As far as all that goes, I dare say it's just make-believe sort of thing old ladies do make up, like seeing flying saucers at the bottom of the garden and Russian agents in the lending library. But it seems quite clear that she did engage this young woman, the lady help, and told her to look for a body, which the girl did."
"And found one," observed the chief constable.
"Well, it's all a very remarkable story."
"Marple. Miss Jane Marple. The name seems familiar somehow.
Anyway, I'll get on to the yard. I think you're right about its not being a local case, though we won't advertise the fact just yet.
For the moment, we'll tell the press as little as possible." The inquest was a purely formal affair. No one came forward to identify the dead woman. Lucy was called to give evidence of finding the body, and medical evidence was given as to the cause of death, strangulation. The proceedings were then adjourned. It was a cold, blustery day when the Crackenthorpe family came out of the hall where the inquest had been held. There were five of them, all told: Emma, Cedric, Harold, Alfred, and Brian Eastley, the husband of the dead daughter Edith. There was also Mr. Wimborne, the senior partner of the firm of solicitors who dealt with the Crackenthorpes' legal affairs. He had come down specially from London at great inconvenience to attend the inquest. They all stood for a moment on the pavement, shivering. Quite a crowd had assembled. The piquant details of the body in the sarcophagus had been fully reported in both the London and the local press. A murmur went round. That's them. Emma said sharply, "Let's get away." The big hired Daimler drew up to the curb. Emma got in and motioned to Lucy. Mr. Wimborne, Cedric and Harold followed. Brian Eastley said,
"I'll take Alfred with me in my little bus."
The chauffeur shut the door, and the Daimler prepared to roll away.
"Oh, stop," cried Emma. "There are the boys."
The boys, in spite of aggrieved protests, had been left behind at Rutherford Hall, but they now appeared, grinning from ear to ear.
"We came on our bicycles," said Stoddart West. "The policeman was very kind and let us in at the back of the hall. I hope you don't mind, Miss Crackenthorpe," he added politely.
"She doesn't mind," said Cedric, answering for his sister. "You're only young ones. Your first inquest, I expect."
"It was rather disappointing," said Alexander. "All over so soon."
"We can't stay here talking," said Harold irritably. "It's quite a crowd. And all those men with cameras."
At a sign from him, the chauffeur pulled away from the curb. The boys waved cheerfully.
"All over so soon," said Cedric. "That's what they think, the young innocents. It's just beginning. It's all very unfortunate." "Most unfortunate," said Harold. "I suppose..."
He looked at Mr. Wimborne, who compressed his thin lips and shook his head with distaste. "I hope," he said sententiously, "that the whole matter will soon be cleared up satisfactorily. The police are very efficient. However, the whole thing, as Harold says, has been most unfortunate." He looked as he spoke at Lucy, and there was distinct disapproval in his glance. If it had not been for this young woman, his eyes seemed to say, poking about where she had no business to be, none of this would have happened. This sentiment, or one closely resembling it, was voiced by Harold Crackenthorpe.
"By the way, Miss, Islesbarrow, just what made you go looking in that sarcophagus?"
Lucy had already wondered just when this thought would occur to one of the family. She had known that the police would ask it first thing. What surprised her was that it seemed to have occurred to no one else until this moment. Cedric, Emma, Harold and Mr. Wimborne all looked at her. Her reply, for what it was worth, had naturally been prepared for some time. "Really," she said in a hesitating voice, "I hardly know. I did feel that the whole place needed a thorough clearing out and cleaning. And there was," she hesitated, "a very peculiar and disagreeable smell." She had counted accurately on the immediate shrinking of everyone from the unpleasantness of this idea. Mr. Wimborne murmured,
"Yes, yes, of course. About 3 weeks, the police surgeon said.
I think, you know, we must all try and not let our minds dwell on this thing." He smiled encouragingly at Emma, who had turned very pale. "Remember," he said, "this wretched young woman was nothing to do with any of us."
"Ah, but you can't be so sure of that, can you?" said Cedric.
Lucy Islesbarrow looked at him with some interest. She had already been intrigued by the rather startling differences between the three brothers. Cedric was a big man with a weather-beaten, rugged face, unkempt dark hair and a jocund manner. He had arrived from the airport unshaven, and though he had shaved in preparation for the inquest, he was still wearing the clothes in which he had arrived, and which seemed to be the only ones he had. Old grey flannel trousers, and a patched and rather threadbare baggy jacket. He looked the stage bohemian to the life, and proud of it. His brother Harold, on the contrary, was the perfect picture of a city gentleman and a director of important companies. He was tall, with a neat, erect carriage, had dark hair going slightly bald on the temples, a small black moustache, and was impeccably dressed in a dark, well-cut suit and a pearl-grey tie. He looked what he was, a shrewd and successful businessman.
he now said stiffly.
Really, Cedric, that seems a most uncalled-for remark.
Don't see why. She was in our barn, after all. What did she come there for?
Mr. Wimborne coughed and said, possibly some assignation. I understand that it was a matter of local knowledge that the key was kept outside on a nail. His tone indicated outrage at the carelessness of such procedure. So clearly marked was this that Emma spoke apologetically. It started during the war for the ARP wardens. There was a little spirit stove and they made themselves hot cocoa. And afterwards, since there was really nothing there anybody could have wanted to take, we went on leaving the key hanging up. It was convenient for the Women's Institute people. If we'd kept it in the house, it might have been awkward, when there was no one at home to give it to them when they wanted it to get the place ready. With only daily women and no resident servants. Her voice tailed away. She had spoken mechanically, giving a wordy explanation without interest, as though her mind was elsewhere. Cedric gave her a quick, puzzled glance. You're worried, sis? What's up? Harold spoke with exasperation. Really, Cedric, can you ask? Yes, I do ask. Granted, a strange young woman has got herself killed in the barn at Rutherford Hall. It sounds like a Victorian melodrama. And granted, it gave Emma a shock at the time. But Emma's always been a sensible girl. I don't see why she goes on being worried now. I dash it. One gets used to everything.
Murder takes a little more getting used to by some people than it may in your case, said Harold acidly. I dare say murders are to a penny in Mallorca and...
Ibiza, not Mallorca.
It's the same thing.
Not at all. It's quite a different island.
Harold went on talking. My point is that though murder may be an everyday commonplace to you, living amongst hot-blooded Latin people, nevertheless in England we take such things seriously. He added with increasing irritation, and really, Cedric, to appear at a public inquest in those clothes?
What's wrong with my clothes? They're comfortable.
They're unsuitable.
Well, anyway, they're the only clothes I've got with me. I didn't pack my wardrobe trunk when I came rushing home to stand in with the family over this business. I'm a painter, and painters like to be comfortable in their clothes.
So, you're still trying to paint?
Look here, Harold. When you say trying to paint...
Mr. Wimborne cleared his throat in an authoritative
manner. This discussion is unprofitable, he said, reprovingly.
I hope, my dear Emma, that you will tell me if there is any further way in which I can be of service to you before I return to town. The reproof had its effect. Emma Crackenthorpe said quickly, It was most kind of you to come down.
Not at all. It was advisable that someone should be at the inquest to watch the proceedings on behalf of the family. I have arranged for an interview with the inspector at the house. I have no doubt that, distressing as all this has been, the situation will soon be clarified. In my own mind, there seems little doubt as to what occurred. As Emma has told us, the key of the long barn was known locally to hang outside the door. It seems highly probable that the place was used in the winter months as a place of assignation by local couples. No doubt there was a quarrel, and some young man lost control of himself. Horrified at what he had done, his eye lit on the sarcophagus, and he realized that it would make an excellent place of concealment. Lucy thought to herself, Yes, sounds most plausible. That's just what one might think.
Cedric said, You say a local couple. Nobody's been able to identify the girl locally.
It's early days yet. No doubt we shall get an identification before long, and it is possible, of course, that the man in question was a local resident, but that the girl came from elsewhere, perhaps from some other part of Brackhampton. Brackhampton's a big place. It's grown enormously in the last 20 years.
If I were a girl coming to meet my young man, I'd not stand for being taken into a freezing cold barn miles from anywhere, Cedric objected. I'd stand out for a nice bit of cuddle in the cinema, wouldn't you, Miss Hilesborough?
Do we need to go into all this? Harold demanded plaintively.
And with the voicing of the question, the car drew up before the front door of Rutherford Hall, and they all got out. Chapter 8. On entering the library, Mr. Wimborne blinked a little as his shrewd old eyes went past Inspector Bacon, whom he had already met, to the fair-haired, good-looking man beyond him. Inspector Bacon performed introductions.
"This is Detective Inspector Craddock of New Scotland Yard," he said.
"New Scotland Yard, Mr. Wimborne's eyebrows rose. Dermot Craddock, who had a pleasant manner, went easily into speech. "We have been called in on the case, Mr. Wimborne," he said. "As you are representing the Crackenthorpe family, I feel it is only fair that we should give you a little confidential information. Nobody could make a better show of presenting a very small portion of the truth and implying that it was the whole truth than Inspector Craddock. Inspector Bacon will agree, I am sure," he added, glancing at his colleague. Inspector Bacon agreed with all due solemnity, and not at all as though the whole matter were prearranged.
"It's like this," said Craddock. "We have reason to believe, from information that has come into our possession, that the dead woman is not a native of these parts, that she travelled down here from London, and that she had recently come from abroad, probably, though we are not sure of that, from France." Mr. Wimborne again raised his eyebrows. "Indeed," he said, "indeed." "That being the case," explained Inspector Bacon, "the chief constable felt that the yard were better fitted to investigate the matter."
"I can only hope," said Mr. Wimborne, "that the case will be solved quickly. As you can no doubt appreciate, the whole business has been a source of much distress to the family. Although not personally concerned in any way, they are..." He paused for a bare second, but Inspector Craddock filled the gap quickly. "It's not a pleasant thing to find a murdered woman on your property. I couldn't agree with you more. Now, I should like to have a brief interview with the various members of the family. I really cannot see what they can tell me. Probably nothing of interest, but one never knows. I dare say I can get most of the information I want from you, sir. Information about this house and the family."
"And what can that possibly have to do with an unknown young woman coming from abroad and getting herself killed here?"
"Well, that's rather the point," said Craddock. "Why did she come here? Had she once had some connection with this house? Had she been, for instance, a servant here at one time? A lady's maid, perhaps? Or did she come here to meet a former occupant of Rutherford Hall?"
Mr. Wimborne said coldly that Rutherford Hall had been occupied by the Crackenthorpes ever since Josiah Crackenthorpe built it in 1884.
"Well, that's interesting in itself," said Craddock. "If you'd just give me a brief outline of the family history..." Mr. Wimborne shrugged his shoulders.
"There's very little to tell. Josiah Crackenthorpe was a manufacturer of sweet and savoury biscuits, relishes, pickles, etc. He accumulated a vast fortune. He built this house. Luther Crackenthorpe, his eldest son, lives here now.
Any other sons?"
"One other son, Henry, who was killed in a motor accident in 1911.
"And the present Mr. Crackenthorpe has never thought of selling the house?"
"He is unable to do so," said the lawyer dryly, "by the terms of his father's will."
"Perhaps you'll tell me about the will."
"Why should I?"
Inspector Craddock smiled. "Because I can look it up myself if I want to, at Somerset House." Against his will, Mr. Wimborne gave a crabbed little smile.
"Quite right, Inspector. I was merely protesting that the information you ask for is quite irrelevant. As to Josiah Crackenthorpe's will, there is no mystery about it. He left his very considerable fortune in trust, the income from it to be paid to his son Luther for life, and after Luther's death, the capital to be divided equally between Luther's children, Edmund, Cedric, Harold, Alfred, Emma, and Edith. Edmund was killed in the war, and Edith died 4 years ago, so that on Luther Crackenthorpe's decease, the money will be divided between Cedric, Harold, Alfred, Emma, and Edith's son, Alexander Eastley."
"And the house?"
That will go to Luther Crackenthorpe's eldest surviving son, or his issue. Was Edmund Crackenthorpe married? No. So the property will actually go to the next son, Cedric. Mr. Luther Crackenthorpe himself cannot dispose of it? No. And he has no control of the capital? No. Isn't that rather unusual? I suppose, said Inspector Craddock shrewdly, that his father didn't like him. You suppose correctly, said Mr. Wimborne. Old Josiah was disappointed that his eldest son showed no interest in the family business, or indeed in business of any kind. Luther spent his time travelling abroad and collecting objets d'art. Old Josiah was very unsympathetic to that kind of thing, so he left his money in trust for the next generation. But in the meantime, the next generation have no income except what they make or what their father allows them. And their father has a considerable income, but no power of disposal of the capital. Exactly. And what all this has to do with the murder of an unknown young woman of foreign origin, I cannot imagine. It doesn't seem to have anything to do with it, Inspector Craddock agreed promptly. I just wanted to ascertain all the facts. Mr. Wimborne looked at him sharply, then, seemingly satisfied with the result of his scrutiny, rose to his feet. I am proposing now to return to London, he said, unless there is anything further you wish to know. He looked from one man to the other. No, thank you, sir. The sound of the gong rose fortissimo from the hall outside. Dear me, said Mr. Wimborne. One of the boys, I think, must be performing. Inspector Craddock raised his voice to be heard above the clamour as he said, We'll leave the family to have lunch in peace, but Inspector Bacon and I would like to return after it, say at 2:15, and have a short interview with every member of the family. You think that is necessary? Well, Craddock shrugged his shoulders, it's just an off chance. Somebody might remember something that would give us a clue to the woman's identity. I doubt it, Inspector. I doubt it very much. But I wish you good luck. As I said just now, the sooner this distasteful business is cleared up, the better for everybody. Shaking his head, he went slowly out of the room. Lucy had gone straight to the kitchen on getting back from the inquest and was busy with preparations for lunch when Brian Eastley put his head in. Can I give you a hand in any way? He asked. I'm handy about the house. Lucy gave him a quick, slightly preoccupied glance. Brian had arrived at the inquest direct in his small MG car, and she had not as yet had much time to size him up. What she saw was likeable enough. Eastley was an amiable-looking young man of 30-odd, with brown hair, rather plaintive blue eyes, and an enormous fair moustache. "Boys aren't back yet," he said, coming in and sitting on the end of the kitchen table. "It'll take them another 20 minutes on their bikes." Lucy smiled. They were certainly determined not to miss anything. Can't blame them. I mean to say, first inquest in their young lives and right in the family, so to speak. Do you mind getting off the table, Mr. Eastley? I want to put the baking dish down there. Brian obeyed. I say, that fat's corking hot. What are you going to put in it? Yorkshire pudding. Good old Yorkshire. Roast beef of old England. Is that the menu for today? Yes. The funeral baked meats, in fact. Smells good. He sniffed appreciatively. Do you mind my gassing away? If you came in to help, I'd rather you helped. She drew another pan from the oven. Here. Turn all these potatoes over so that they brown on the other side. Brian obeyed with alacrity. Have all these things been fizzling away in here while we've been at the inquest? Supposing they'd been all burnt up? Most improbable. There's a regulating number on the oven. Kind of electric brain, eh, what? Is that right? Lucy threw a swift look in his direction. Quite right. Now, put the pan in the oven. Here, take the cloth. On the second shelf, I want the top one for the Yorkshire pudding. Brian obeyed, but not without uttering a shrill yelp. Burn yourself? Just a bit. Doesn't matter. What a dangerous game cooking is. I suppose you never do your own cooking. Well, as a matter of fact, I do, quite often. But not this sort of thing. I can boil an egg, if I don't forget to look at the clock. And I can do eggs and bacon. And I can put a steak under the grill, or open a tin of soup. I've got one of those little electric whatnots in my flat. You live in London? If you call it living, yes. His tone was despondent. He watched Lucy shoot in the dish with the Yorkshire pudding mixture. This is awfully jolly, he said, and sighed. Her immediate preoccupations over, Lucy looked at him with more attention. What is? This kitchen? Yes. Reminds me of our kitchen at home, when I was a boy. It struck Lucy that there was something strangely forlorn about Brian Eastley. Looking closely at him, she realized that he was older than she had at first thought. He must be close on 40. It seemed difficult to think of him as Alexander's father. He reminded her of innumerable young pilots she had known during the war when she had been at the impressionable age of 14. She had gone on and grown up into a post-war world, but she felt as though Brian had not gone on, but had been passed by in the passage of years. His next words confirmed this. He had subsided onto the kitchen table again. It's a difficult sort of world, he said, isn't it? To get your bearings in, I mean. You see, one hasn't been trained for it. Lucy recalled what she had heard from Emma. You were a fighter pilot, weren't you? She said. You've got a DFC. Oh, that's the sort of thing that puts you wrong. You've got a gong, and so people try to make it easy for you. Give you a job and all that. Very decent of them. But they're all admin jobs, and one simply isn't any good at that sort of thing. Sitting at a desk getting tangled up in figures. I've had ideas of my own, you know, tried out a wheeze or two, but you can't get the backing. Can't get the chaps to come in and put down the money. I had a bit of capital. He brooded. You didn't know Edie, did you? My wife? Well, no, of course you didn't. She was quite different from all this lot. Younger, for one thing. She was in the WAF. She always said her old man was crackers. He is, you know. Mean as hell over money. And it's not as though he could take it with him. It's got to be divided up when he dies. Edie's share will go to Alexander, of course. He won't be able to touch the capital until he's 21, though. I'm sorry, but will you get off the table again? I want to dish up and make gravy. At that moment, Alexander and Stoddart West arrived with rosy faces and very much out of breath. Hello, Brian, said Alexander kindly to his father. So this is where you've got to. I say, what a smashing piece of beef. Is there Yorkshire pudding? Yes, there is. We have awful Yorkshire pudding at school, all damp and limp. Get out of my way, said Lucy. I want to make the gravy. Oh, make lots of gravy. Can we have two sauce boats full? Yes. Good-o, said Stoddart West. I don't like it pale, said Alexander anxiously. It won't be pale. She's a smashing cook, said Alexander to his father. Lucy had a momentary impression that their roles were reversed. Alexander spoke like a kindly father to his son. Can we help you, Miss Islesborough? Asked Stoddart West politely. Yes, you can. Alexander, go and sound the gong. James, will you carry this tray into the dining room? And will you take the joint in, Mr. Eastley? I'll bring the potatoes and the Yorkshire pudding. There's a Scotland Yard man here, said Alexander. Do you think he will have lunch with us? That depends on what your aunt arranges. I don't suppose Aunt Emma would mind. She's very hospitable. But I suppose Uncle Harold wouldn't like it. It's being very sticky over this murder. Alexander went out through the door with the tray, adding a little additional information over his shoulder. Mr. Wimborne's in the library with the Scotland Yard man now, but he isn't staying to lunch. He said he had to get back to London. Come on, Stodders. Oh, he's gone to do the gong. At that moment, the gong took charge. Stoddart West was an artist. He gave it everything he had, and all further conversation was inhibited. Brian carried in the joint. Lucy followed with the vegetables, returning to the kitchen to get the two brimming sauce boats of gravy. Mr. Wimborne was standing in the hall putting on his gloves as Emma came quickly down the stairs. "Are you really sure you won't stop for lunch, Mr. Wimborne? It's all ready."
"No, I have an important appointment in London. There is a restaurant car on the train."
"It was very good of you to come down," said Emma gratefully. The two police officers emerged from the library. Mr. Wimborne took Emma's hand in his. "There's nothing to worry about, my dear," he said. "This is Detective Inspector Craddock from New Scotland Yard, who has come down to take charge of the case. He is coming back at 2:15 to ask you for any facts that may assist him in his inquiry. But, as I say, you have nothing to worry about." He looked towards Craddock. "I may repeat to Miss Crackenthorpe what you have told me?"
"Certainly, sir."
"Inspector Craddock has just told me that this almost certainly was not a local crime. The murdered woman is thought to have come from London and was probably a foreigner." Emma Crackenthorpe said sharply, "A foreigner? Was she French?" Mr. Wimborne had clearly meant his statement to be consoling. He looked slightly taken aback. Dermot Craddock's glance went quickly from him to Emma's face. He wondered why she had leapt to the conclusion that the murdered woman was French, and why that thought disturbed her so much.
End of Disc 2.